Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you're frustrated with typical hunting and fishing magazines and tired of reading content meant for guys that are up in the north or up in the Midwest, check out Great Days Outdoors Magazine. Don't get left behind following the guidance of guys who don't fish or hunt in your home state. You can pick up a Great Days Outdoors Magazine subscription, and it will help you become a better Southern outdoorsman. Great Days Outdoors Magazine can be found at your local Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Tractor Supply Company, Rural King, Bass Pro Shops, or you can save online at greatdaysoutdoors.com. NCX. As a landowner, the more income I can generate from my land, the better I can take care of it. That's why I use NCX. NCX helps over 20,000 American landowners like you understand and maximize the value of every acre. Find new revenue streams for your land with programs like timber, carbon, wildlife habitat, solar energy, and more. Get started with a free account at ncx.com and discover the true value of your land. I'm your host, Joe Baia, here today with my co-host, Butch Theory. Today, Butch, we got a cool story. Almost, you could read this like a how-to. Really interesting story coming from Nine Line Farms. Wes and Laura Madden, they're going to be giving us their tale of how they came to raise Wagyu cattle, but also just shed a lot of light on what it takes to do this, to do it in a profitable way, and a lot of the challenges they've faced and how they've overcome them. It's going to be an interesting show for people that are maybe interested in getting into Wagyu. But bottom line, man, this stuff is crazy delicious too. I mean, there's a lot of health benefits with raising cattle the right way. Well, we're going to definitely learn about some of that. But, you know, like I said, I mean, you've had a chance to try this stuff.
Absolutely. It was very, very special. I was a little bit worried about, you know, overcooking it. The wife's pregnant and we split the ribeye. So I was kind of worried about the, you know, finding the right medium there. And man, it was just so rich. The only thing that I might have done a little bit wrong is maybe a little bit too much salt, just because it was so, so rich.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was still phenomenal. Luckily, I like salt. So it was amazing. I'm really looking forward to getting into this. I can't even imagine how much work it takes to raise 100 head of cattle. I can't really even imagine.
Yeah.
I would think they eat a lot, and there's a lot of day-to-day things that you don't even think about that they're doing to, you know, produce the highest quality cow possible.
Yeah. I mean, I have a hard time with dealing with my property, and we're not raising any animals. It's all wild animals. And only,
I just got one kid.
Right. I say the only two wild animals I have to take care of are my two boys. So
exactly.
You know, and there, that's enough. That's a handful right there. So
definitely.
Yeah, there's a lot to it. We're going to get into all the details. And to do that today, we are joined by Wes Madden again and his wife, Laura. Today, we're going to be getting a lot more information about Wagyu cattle. First, guys, Wes, welcome back. Laura, welcome to Huntland. Before we jump into all the nitty gritty behind what you guys are doing there at Nine Line Wagyu, tell us a little bit about how you got started. First, where'd that name come from?
Well, thanks for having us again. Had a blast on the last podcast, and I'm super excited to be here with Laura to talk about the ranch and everything we got going on here. How we got into it, you know, it was middle of COVID. I had just closed on selling a business up in Alaska, and we had some capital, and we're sitting there. We actually were sitting on 330 acres up in Bonifay that a buddy and I had just bought speculatively. It was a great deal. Wasn't marketed well. We looked at it and we go, oh, here's our hunting land, you know,
yeah.
So pun intended. And so we bought it, and, you know, we hunted on it for a little bit, but you know, there was always like, what are we going to do with this land? We didn't really have a plan. Well, we had some friends from Bend, Oregon that would come visit us in Florida. And when they would come, they'd bring this meat from their farm. The farm, it was Two Sisters Ranch up in Bend, Oregon, Brian and Rainey Boma. And they'd bring this 100% full blood Wagyu, and we would have a cookout, and I'd eat this meat, and gosh, I just never had anything like it before. It was not only was the best meat I've ever had. At the time, I was pretty strict keto. I was eating keto. So like, when, you know, and I don't know if you guys have ever eaten keto. I was doing it for a while. It was really fun because when you eat a really great fat source, it literally goes, I mean, it creates ketones. It goes straight to your brain. And I'm like, I had a rush like no other. And I said, what am I eating here? And that's where we'd start talking. And Brian Araney would start talking about the breed and, you know, the history and the health benefits. And Laura, I mean, you see Laura in the gym. I mean, we're both health conscious. We care about what we eat. We're not psychos about it, but we care about what we put into our bodies and what we feed our kids. And growing up in Alaska, I mean, spending the, most of our married life, adult life in Alaska, we were primarily eating wild meat and fish that we had caught ourselves. I honestly had never really bought a lot of meat in the stores. So when we moved to Florida, we found ourselves going to the stores and we were buying meat, and even you buy the prime ribeye and it was like, okay, but I always like felt my stomach hurt after I ate it. I never felt really great when I ate it, but I would eat this meat that Brian and Rainey would bring down, and you didn't have to eat a lot, but it was just such an experience. I was just fascinated by it. So we started really looking into it, really kind of learning more about the Wagyu breed. We were going to be, we really became consumers ourselves. And then all of a sudden Brian and Rainey called me, you know, because COVID ended for us early, but for folks living in Oregon, not so much. So they called us and said, hey, Wes, we need you to help us move to Florida. We're moving. So, and not only was it them, but it was like their two daughters and their families, and then a couple friends. I mean, it was like the mass exodus from Oregon to Florida. And so it was really great for real estate, for the real estate business. Plus we were bringing friends closer to us. But I asked them, I was like, what are you doing with the ranch? What are you doing with the cattle? And they go, I don't know. I guess we'll just like do a disbursement sale and just sell it all off. And I looked at Laura and I said, well, we'll buy all your stuff. I mean, we'll buy half your herd. I mean, we had this cash infusion. We needed to do something with it. We wanted to reinvest into something. And why not this like new breed that we were learning about and so passionate about? And so, yeah, I mean, over the course of several months, a couple semi-truck loads, we moved a lot of equipment from Bend, Oregon, down here. And how many animals did we have? Did we bring? It's about 50 head. We brought down, you know, mamas and some calves, and we had some steers. So we kind of had a base. We went through the herd and picked out which ones we wanted, and so we could kind of start the business from the ground up. And the great thing was we had Brian and Rainey there to consult us that first year, and that was really critical because we had no idea what we were doing.
That's a cool story. You know, like
that is a cool story. I can't imagine the logistics of getting all that stuff down, not to mention all the cattle.
Yeah, I have a hard enough time taking my tractor back and forth from the camp. I can't imagine moving cows across the country, but
with a couple kids, right?
Yeah, right. You know, you talking about really, it was that first bite that kind of stemmed that interest, piqued that interest. I know, like, first time I tried it, I was like, how do I fence the deer out of my property and just want to put Wagyu on it? Like, let's keep them off, you know? But no, I mean, the stuff is unbelievable from a flavor perspective. What I want to know is, did y'all have a background in cattle? Like, did y'all get into this, you know, and having grown up in cattle? Because, you know, a lot of landowners, myself included, Butch included, never really grew up with it, but it's certainly something that, you know, we all utilize beef and appreciate beef.
Yeah. I grew up in Nebraska year round. I mean, I grew up in an agricultural community, if you will, you know, and I worked, I mostly worked growing up, you know, walking beans to tasseling corn, throwing hay bales, you know, the farmers would hire you. And we'd work our tails off on all the local farms, but I primarily did, you know, produce and row cropping, working with some of the row croppers there. And I didn't really like it. You know what I mean? I'm like, that never appealed to me. The whole monocropping culture. I'm really not a green thumb. So I wasn't passionate about it. So I always had in the back of my mind, like, you know, I was very interested in animals, you know, of some sort. And so it wasn't until the opportunity with Two Sisters Ranch came up, you know, did, you know, full blood Japanese Wagyu even come into the picture. But Laura comes from the cattle family.
Yeah. So my grandfather always had cattle the whole time we were growing up. But our experience with it was we would just go to the farm and feed them cubes. And, you know, it was more of just enjoying them from afar. We really weren't part of the taking care of them or any of the processing or any of that, other than that they were just fun to be around. And we thought they were cool that, you know, that he had cows. And then once he passed, my dad took them over. And so now that Wes and I have joined into the whole cattle world, my dad just glows.
Yeah.
You know, it's something cool that he can, you know, relate to. He loves that we're into it. It's been really great to share with him. But never have I had to like work them or do any of that until now. So
yeah, trial by fire, I would imagine.
Yeah. And when you buy a herd, I mean, Laura and I sold a business, sold everything we had, and moved 5,000 miles from Alaska to Florida. So we're used to making big, bold moves. We make a decision, we do it, we burn the boats. And so we had a crash course in learning everything we possibly could about the cattle industry, the meat business, the breed. And like we do everything, we dive into it and, you know, and just absorbed ourselves into it. And really leaned on a lot of like, you know, the community has been really great, you know, so leaning on other breeders. We quickly made friends with a lot of excellent breeders. Everyone has been so helpful. And, you know, I mean, you got to put in the work, you know, and we knew with the breed that what you do with this breed, and we'll talk about the husbandry later, but you know, it's different than anything else. You know what I mean? I mean, our ranch manager right now, Ed Barfield, old cowboy, he's been doing commercial cattle stuff for, you know, since he was a boy, and he's, you know, it's been a learning curve for him too. So it's fun to learn new things, you know, and regardless of the industry, and this has really been no different.
Very cool.
I've always heard that about Wagyu. The analogy I've always heard is what sparkling wine is to champagne is what Wagyu is to Kobe. And I think we always heard about Kobe beef for a long time. And maybe some folks have seen the documentaries of folks out there doing like seemingly very different things with Kobe beef. Is that an accurate analogy? Like is all Kobe Wagyu?
Great question. All Kobe beef is Wagyu. Not all Wagyu beef is Kobe. You know, in order for it to be Kobe, it actually needs to be raised in. So it depends on the point of origin. So the only difference between our beef and Kobe Wagyu is because Kobe is produced in the Hyogo Prefecture in Japan. That's it. But the same Tajima genetic lines that produce Kobe beef, those are the same genetics that we have on our farm right now. So that's what's pretty cool. So anyways, and there's a lot of misinformation when it comes to Wagyu and explaining the different breeds and you know, American, Australian, you know, deciphering all that.
So what sets Wagyu apart from the other cattle breeds?
Well, a lot. I mean, I think first and foremost, it's the umami experience, right? Umami is the Japanese word for savory. It's that it's your fifth taste sense. And when you, and I usually ask people, like I've talked to some people and they'll say, I've had Wagyu, it was okay. To which I usually reply, you haven't had full blood. And full blood Wagyu, when you have something that's never been crossed with any other breed, there's, and we'll talk about the genetics here in a little bit on why, but the full blood Japanese black Wagyu produces a tremendous amount of monounsaturated fat with a very low melting point. And what that does is it creates that savory umami experience. And once you've had it, you're ruined forever because it's unlike anything else. You should feel like you've got chapstick on your lips a little bit from the low melting point of the fat. I mean, it's like, and that's that taste sensation that you just cannot duplicate with any other breed, even other Wagyu breeds. But to your point, there's four different Wagyu breeds. There's the Japanese black, which we raise, Kurogi. That's about 90% of all Wagyu in Japan, produced in Japan. And they produce that because they appreciate the marbling. You know, if you've ever had A5 or seen an A5 Wagyu piece of meat, you can see how marbled it is. They really like to get to that high marbling content, the intermuscular fat that's so delicious that we all like. And then you have the red or brown Wagyu. You know, in America, we call it Akaushi. That's a different breed. They look brown or reddish if you ever see them. It is a Wagyu breed. It is not, it doesn't have the same genetic profile as the blacks, which is why we stay full blood. Then you have the Shorthorn, which is another breed. And then lastly, the Japanese Polled. So there's four different Wagyu breeds in existence. Now, back to the blacks. The initial imports in the United States started in 1976 when Jerry Reeves, good friend of ours, Dr. Jerry Reeves and several others out of Washington State flew over to Japan and were able to bring some genetics back. There were some foundational sires that did come over from 1976 all the way to 1997, I believe. Japan actually shut down the exportation of Wagyu genetics in 1997 on the black Wagyu because they declared it a national treasure. So what we got is what we got. And the good thing was they were able to get all the foundational sires. They were able to get genetics from all the foundational sires. So everything that is bred, any Wagyu, black Wagyu bred in the United States, it all originates from those initial importations. Conversely, Australia, everything Australia breeds comes from the United States. So anything Australia produces comes from the genetic lines that we've produced in the United States. So it's a great story. We actually had the opportunity to listen to Dr. Reeves tell the story about getting into Japan and bringing some of the genetics and some of the animals back. And it's quite the story, man, what they went through.
So you guys are producing Wagyu that is made in America, so to speak. Sure, that makes some people excited. You know, they can go out and look for American Wagyu. You know, is there distinctions that need to be made, though? I feel like a lot of times with marketing, people love to latch on to a word. You know, I mean, you know, USDA organic is a good example of that, where, you know, the roots were strong, but a lot of times people are attaching that label just because they want to sell something. So what are the distinctions that are important to understand when it comes to Wagyu that is being produced in the United States?
Yeah, great question. And this is one that frustrates especially full-blood Wagyu producers because the labeling standards on Wagyu are very loose. So what's important to understand is unless the label says 100% full-blood Wagyu, it's not 100% full-blood Wagyu. Okay, so then you hear American Wagyu. American Wagyu is typically what we call an F1, which just means it's 50-50 Wagyu and some other breed, typically Angus. You get higher yield, a little more hardy carcasses, better birthing or less birthing challenges. So the majority of the Wagyu that's, you know, in restaurants or available to the public is going to be that cross. Okay. Same thing with Australian. If it says Australian Wagyu, it's likely an F1 steak, or meat. It's crossed with another breed. So as you're kind of looking through, you can even have like F2, which would be 75%, or even purebred. A lot of people go like, they'll say purebred, and I'll have to correct them and say, no, it's full blood. Purebred could be, only needs to qualify at like 93.75 Wagyu. So the key distinction that you have to, the labeling claim you must look for is 100% full blood. And that's where you get all that umami experience, all the health benefits, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. Really comes from the 100% full blood, and it's that would be the top shelf.
Very cool. Seems like there's a lot to it, a lot more than you would initially think. Very cool. I like the history of that stuff. I can only imagine what Mr. Reeves had to go through in Japan to go over there and get that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, and that's why, like, I think Wendy's or Arby's is selling a Wagyu burger. Well, it's not 100% full blood Japanese black Wagyu. It's one of the other, you know, it's probably Yakaushi, and it's mixed with something else, and it's commercially raised and everything else. So you're not going to get that flavor explosion. You're not going to get that experience. And so it's really difficult. I mean, the American Wagyu Association, we're really pushing hard for the USDA to provide labeling standards. And it's difficult because we're really small, and the commercial guys that have all the lobbying money, you know, obviously we're just small potatoes compared to them. So we're really kind of fighting an uphill battle. But the best thing that we could do is educate consumers, which we do, interested buyer to interested buyer, and on podcasts like this. So I appreciate you having us on so we can explain all that.
Yeah, of course. And before we get into the nitty gritty of your operation there, tell us about the name. I want to hear about the name. How did Nine Line Wagyu come to be about?
Yeah, so Nine Line Wagyu, when we were sitting around kind of thinking about what we wanted to call the ranch, what we wanted to call the operation, you know, our last podcast talked about my military experience, you know, the history of being a medevac pilot and coming to save people and how rewarding of a career that was the time I was doing it. You know, we really kind of, this was a passion project for us. We never set out to really do anything other than just follow our hearts. We felt led to do this. And we believe that the food system in the United States is broken, and that we need to get back to, traditional food production, meaning, community farms, knowing your farmer, knowing where your food comes from. And we felt like, you know, we can't fix the broken food system. We can't fix the health care system. But what we can do is we can do this, and we can at least do something. We're do it people. You know what I mean? We're not going to sit around and feel sorry for ourselves. We're going to do something about it. And so Nine Line, you know, when you're on the battlefield and you need help, a Nine Line medevac request is 911 on the battlefield. So I got a guy, you know, a guy, you know, if a guy gets hurt out on the battlefield, I got a grunt that's getting on the radio, and he's making what's called a 9-line medevac request. So we would be in the hangar ready to go, or sleep in our Blackhawks, and we get a radio call, and you know, 4 minutes later we're pulling pitch and heading down range to go save somebody. And that's so that whole ethos that we carried, that, and my wife was part of that journey, being a spouse, you know, and me being down range. So it's so ingrained in who we are that that we wanted to carry that along, that history along with us, to name the ranch. And it's also kind of cool when you get a military buyer, they'll reach out and be like, "Were you ex-military?" And I'll say yes, and they go, "I love the name, man." You know, or they'll see our brand and they'll ask, "What does that brand mean?" You know, and it's like, "Oh, it's Nine Line."
Very cool.
I love that message, because, you know, I talk to a lot of people about habitat management with their land, you know, and a lot of people will not do something because they feel like, you know, well, I just got 40 acres, or I've just got, you know, what I do on my place is not going to make a big enough difference on a big scale, you know, like it would if an institutional timber landowner, you know, made that decision to manage their property that way. And, you know, or I'm not going to do that. You know, the economies of scale aren't there. You know, there's lots of different reasons why you can choose not to do something that you feel led to do. And it's very much that way with land ownership. You've sometimes you got to make the right decision for the property, and it's not the best economic decision. And a lot of times your passion leads you to making those decisions. And some of the experiences I've had have been that, you know, my passion drives me there, but when I get there, it's actually pretty challenging to stay the course, because you're looking at it going, okay, this is a big financial commitment. This is not what I thought it was going to be. Like, this is harder, you know. And I'll use the example, Butch and I talk a lot about food plotting on here, and, you know, no-till versus conventional tillage agriculture. Like, it's just not easy. It takes a change in equipment, a change in implements, a change in mindset. You've got to pay more attention to what you're doing, and the rewards, the payoff are years away. It's not something you're going to see this growing season. So when you guys decided to get into this, I'm sure y'all were super fired up and you were super excited, but I imagine there had to be some pretty big challenges initially, or maybe some you're still going through. I mean, the first thing I can think of is, like, Oregon's a lot different environment than Florida. I mean, how'd the cattle do when they got to Florida?
Great question. You know, shipping animals across the country is really hard. It was a 4-day journey. By the time they made it, you know, a few of the steers, man, it was hard on them. I mean, so you get a good cattle hauler that stops, lets them out, they rest overnight. You know, a good cattle hauler knows where to go to get them some feed and some water. Everyone made it safely, thankfully, but that's a long trip. You know, we actually have changed since doing that. We really don't, ship animals very far. We really don't like going above the Mason-Dixon line or west of Texas. You know,
that's just a general rule.
Yeah, it is too far for the animals. And quite honestly, an old cattle hauler told me one time, he'd been doing this for 40, 50 years. And he said, "Wes, the rule of thumb is you never ship an animal from west to east or north to south, because it's hard on their rumen. Because the forage is different. So their rumen develops differently. Their hair follicles are different. If I bring an animal down from the north, the hair follicles they got are the hair follicles they have. So when I bring an animal down, if I purchase an animal that's living in the north and I bring him to the south, they have a hard time. So we really, we saw that really early on.
Y'all did north to south and west to east.
That's right. Yeah. Sadly, I mean, we actually had two cows that didn't make it in their first year, you know, and that hurt. Each one of those were, you know, $10,000 animals. And we actually took them up to Auburn. The Auburn vet clinic up there was amazing.
More Eagle.
Yeah. And we ended up, you know, euthanizing them because they had fat necrosis so bad. So this animal, there's a lot that even vets don't really know. They did a necropsy on them and tried to really kind of figure out what went wrong. And the thing about this breed is, and we'll talk about the husbandry practices, but stress. So these animals, full blood Wagyu, they generate about 30% more cortisol than the average English breed. So low stress is very important. If you come to the farm, we're not rounding the animals up with machines or anything like that. It's all about very low stress. When we work the animals, everything's very calm, you know.
No political conversations.
We don't talk politics with them. Yeah, no. We got a steady diet of good country, old country music, and we keep them real happy. So it's very important you limit the stress, but transport, a lot of stress involved with the animals. So we've got a great group of regional breeders that we work with, and we keep the travel times down for the animals.
What did y'all find really helpful starting out? You know, you mentioned you've talked to people that have been in the industry for their whole lives. What resources did y'all find really helpful with full blood Wagyu or just ranching in general?
We obviously learned a tremendous amount from Brian and Rainey, who over the course of 10 years built this herd. And like everybody, you know, you kind of, any business venture, you pay the dumb tax and you pay that forward to someone else, you know, in your mentorship. And they did the same thing for us. So we really kind of started on third base in a lot of respects. And I think at some point they were getting, you know, I think Brian was probably getting real sick and tired of all the one-off questions I was hitting him up with. About anything and everything, you know, but they were so gracious in answering all of our questions because they had been there before. And so we really started with a leg up by acquiring, really, we kind of acquired the business. So a lot of the mistakes they'd made and successes they had had, we took that and then went from there. And then beyond that, reading anything and everything we could get our hands on, really diving in and then also collaborating with other breeders who have been successful, you know, breeders that have been in the business for many, many years, who have also been on this journey for a long time. And, you know, Reed Smith up at Wilders Wagyu in Turkey, North Carolina. I mean, we've got such a great partnership with them. You know, it's just unbelievable the friends we've made in this business, you know, because we're all in it together. We all have the same passion. We all have the same vision for what we're looking to do. And there's plenty for everyone to go around. I mean, it's been amazing how gracious the community's been in collaboration. You know, when you go to an auction, usually when we go to an animal auction, we do farm tours. I mean, we go around and we're able to ask questions and, hey, how are you doing this? How are you doing? You know, and that's been so immensely helpful.
Very cool. So I'm really interested in the day-to-day operation. Like in the mornings, do you like wake up and you putting Garth Brooks on their headphones for all the cows and like sprinkling diamonds on the grass, or like do they have special diets, or just kind of walk us through what a day looks like on the Wagyu cattle farm?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, daily it's, you know, we feed them twice a day. We feed the animals twice a day. So, you know, the chickens, we got an automatic door. So the chickens come out and the farm, you know, kind of comes to life, if you will. So we feed out the fats. We do finish our steers, predominantly on our farm. So the important thing is we get all their rations done, and then we feed out the remaining animals. We make sure our calves get good starter feed, that they got creep feeders, that they're able to get access to good starter feed after they hit the ground, that critical first couple months. It's, you know, so that they get that jump start. But something that, you know, even some Wagyu breeders don't know is, you know, the time where that intermuscular fat, that adipose tissue is formed is in the second and third trimester. While they're in their mother's womb. So when our mamas are pregnant, once they hit that second, third trimester, it's a 9-month gestation cycle. We start supplementing them a little bit to make sure that they've got enough energy to pass along to that calf in their belly, so that when that calf drops, the adipose tissue is formed and that animal's ready to be successful, you know, throughout their life. Beyond that, the daily chores, I mean, it's a farm, right? It never ends, right? So you got just general ranching. You're always fixing something, perimeter fence checks, gate checks. We're making sure that we don't see sign of predators. That's something, you know, that's something that, you know, Cowboy Ed's really great at. He's managed ranches his entire career. And we keep a watchful eye on the predators in the area. Thankfully, we've not had any issue aside from one wild boar that got in one of our pastures, that his horse, he's got a stud quarter horse, Hotshot. Hotshot took that boar on. It was about a 200 pounder. He got a little dinged up, Ed was able to take care of the hog, and Hotshot got a beer at the end of the day. Yeah. He was pretty happy about that, but his gray horse. But that's something that we're actually breeding some pasture protector mules right now. So we want in every paddock, we'll have one pasture protector mule that will live alongside the mama cows. And they actually assimilate when you keep just one in there. And mules are really great because they're a little bit better, smarter than donkeys. And they tend to be, you can kind of breed them to get to be the right height. You don't want them too tall because hogs can get under them and stuff like that. But the mules, we're pretty excited about the mules coming. We got a couple ponies right now that are getting bred, and we should have mules hopefully next spring that we'll introduce to the ranch, and that'll help keep the herd safe. But beyond that, it's clean water, cleaning water troughs. You know, this breed, you know, the marbling can change up to 10-15% based on the quality of water. So we went all in on making sure we've got the best water on our ranch. We hired Tina Peters with Mallard Consulting. She's our environmental engineer. She tests our water once a month. We fix the pH in our water. We actually noticed that the pH was a little off. We kind of solved for iron and everything else, but the water that we're producing at the ranch is some of the best water you can get in Florida, and that's what our animals are drinking. So we want to make sure that they get good clean water. We're actually going to be a part, and we're actually working with the USDA NRCS department. We're excited because at the end of May we're doing an EQIP on both parcels of our farm, and we're going to be a pilot program for a new watering system. We really wanted to move to a algae-free water system, and it also helps preserve water. So instead of having this 300-gallon trough that we have to dump once a week, it's just wasting water. And also, there's no cover on it, so it grows algae, right?
Right.
So we wanted to move to a Mirafount watering system with that has balls on it. It closes off the sunlight to it, so it actually eliminates algae from the water, so that the animals are drinking much better water. And then you only have to clean them out once a week, and it's a simple clean out. You're just kind of cleaning out some of the residue at the bottom of the waterer. But so we're going to be the first pilot program in Florida for that with the USDA, which we're very excited about. That's one step closer to our regenerative farming. You know, like you said, doesn't happen overnight, right? It's just right. One more step. And then beyond that, observing the herd, making sure everyone looks, you know, your Ed's real great about, looking over all the animals. We get eyes on every single one of our animals every single day. If there's an issue, we deal with it. When calving, we're in breeding season right now. Saturday, we're doing embryo transfers on 10 recip girls. These are Hereford Devon recipient cows that will be placing fertilized embryos into them. It will probably get about a 60, hopefully 70% take rate. And 9 months later, we hope to be dropping full blood Wagyu calves. So that's a little bit of work. But outside of, you know, and then when calving season comes around, you're watching 24 hours a day. So we're taking shifts, you know, and we're watching the herd, and we're watching those mamas to look for sign, because one thing with the Wagyu breed, if you ever look at a Wagyu cow, you'll notice that their front shoulders are really big, and their hindquarters are maybe not as big as like some of the typical English breeds. And so calving difficulty is a thing with the breed. So you got to be watching. You might need to be, you know, and so you got to watch for calving issues, so that if we have to pull a calf, if that calf drops and doesn't start nursing right away, we gotta make sure we bring him into the calf rehab pen, and we can start getting some colostrum down them, because it's very critical in that first hour that they're getting some milk in them. But mama's milk is certainly always the best.
All right, folks, we're gonna be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. First South Farm Credit. What does a farm mean to you? Maybe it's just a piece of land where you can go relax or enjoy the outdoors. Whatever the farm means to you, First South Farm Credit can help you finance or refinance that perfect piece of land. As a successful financial cooperative, First South shares its profits with its borrowers in the form of a patronage refund, which lowers your cost of borrowing. To find out how First South can help you, visit their website at firstsouthland.com or call them at 800-955-1722. They are an equal housing lender. Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has produced the best engineered and finest quality feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. The Texas Hunter brand has become synonymous with quality and durability. By sticking to premium standards, the company delivers tough, long-lasting products that meet the real-life needs of anglers and hunters across America. Their fish feeders, deer feeders, hunting blinds, and outdoor accessories are among the highest rated in the industry. You can trust that your purchase from Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. To learn more, visit texashunter.com.
You mentioned you guys brought about 50 head from Oregon. How many do you have now?
Oh, we're sitting just shy of 100 right now. Wow. Yeah, we'll have, I think this fall we got maybe close to 20 calves dropping. So the herd fluctuates based on the calves that drop. And but it's about a 50-50 shot. When you drop, you know, if you got 20 calves, you can reasonably assume you're going to get 10 replacement heifers and 10 steers. So we try to run when you're starting out, every single animal needs to be bred and every single animal needs to be putting calves on the ground. So we want to get to where we have two distinct, you know, a very tight spring and very tight fall breeding season so that we have tight fall and spring calving seasons because of that 24-hour day watching. Because every single one of the animals that's dropping, that's a $10,000, you know, wagyu baby. So every single calf that drops on our farm is critically important to the operation.
Glad to hear you bring up regenerative ag and a lot of the, you know, a lot of what I've seen and read, you know, about ranching in general, not necessarily with full blood wagyu, but just ranching in general is, you know, the restorative effects that cattle can have on the land when handled properly. You know, with that being said, have you guys faced any challenges with the land itself, you know, with your pastures? Have you had to make any big changes there? I sold a piece of land not too far from you guys that was in perennial peanut. And he was sought after in the area for his hay and that production. But what have you guys done with your pastures? Have you had to make any big changes there?
Huge changes. So very early on, I'd say after our first year, we kind of came to the conclusion, we really wanted to establish a regenerative pasture system. I didn't feel right having animals grazing on our pastures and then spraying chemicals on those pastures and then having them eat that grass. And then somehow that, you know, being absorbed into the food that we're providing, that seemed counter to really our vision of what we wanted to produce for our consumers and for ourselves. So we actually, along with Tina Peters at Mallard, we also connected with Phil Burton at Regenerative Solutions. And Phil, he's been a godsend in helping us get our pastures, getting the biology right. You know, our pastures are really dead we had a back 80 field that was cultivated for peanuts. And we did soil tests and there was no life in the field whatsoever. It was literally dead. So we knew that we needed to do something different. So we do twice annually spraying of compost tea to introduce the fungi into the soils to really, and then we monitor that root growth, right? So we want nice long roots on our hay. And making sure that the ecosystem in the pastures is operating as it should. We introduced dung beetles into the fields. The dung beetles are hard at work. They're seemingly everywhere. I mean, cow patties don't last a week in our pastures, which is really neat to see. I told Laura we took a video of the dung beetles going crazy on a cow pie. And I'm like, we're posting this to social media, man. This is so cool. Like, we're literally gonna post cow poop on social media, but it's important and it's. And the end result is when we get our soil tests back, we don't have to add any fertilizer. We don't have to add potash. We don't have to add lime, any of the other stuff. We're not adding anything to our, like it's operating as it should. We leave some weeds in the fields. We pull the ones that are not good for the animals. We leave some that are good. There actually are some weeds that are good. You don't just go kill everything. Some things are really good for the animals and the ecosystem. So that's been really, you know, in Phil, when we take these soil samples, his wife is a biologist. And so she gets under the microscope. We look at the soil under the microscope and really kind of look at what's the fungal action going on in the soils. And it's just to see where we were to where we are now. It's really cool. And that's been great. You know, a couple of our pastures, what we did was we actually planted Bahia and we stripped out perennial peanut hay. So We're testing that out. The University of Florida Cooperative Extension in Marianna, Jose DeBoe, the professor there at Forage, really recommended that we give that a shot. And so we didn't get that encompassed into an EQIP. So the USDA did cover like 90% of the cost. You know, I say that in quotations because that's not all the cost, but some of it certainly helped. And that's been we've had a little bit of learning curve learning that, but it's been great. I mean, it's, you know, that legume is putting nitrogen in the ground, along with rotationally grazing the animals, flash grazing that regenerated pasture. It's really worked out well. We've got some, we are actually working right now to create a silva pasture north of our east paddock.
Cool. You doing longleaf?
Well, some longleaf. We got a variety of species in there, but we're in the clearing process right now. We're excited to get that going, but that'll add another 50 acres to really allow us to be able to truly, get our rotationally grazing down, to where it really starts working. And the other thing is, water, you know, getting water to the animals. So the USDA does provide, you know, cost sharing through the EQIP program to be able to put solar powered wells strategically located in all your pastures so that you can have watering points for all your animals. Cause that's certainly a concern. And if you're going to rotationally graze, we like to do like a centralized watering point, and then we'll pinwheel around that centralized watering point. So the animals always got access to water, but then they got that fresh forage that we can move them every 3 days to. And that's the long-term plan. Our south pasture's got that established now. We're going to be incorporating that in our other pastures moving forward.
But it feels great to be able to work with the land, you know, and see your business side of this growing, but at the same time, watch those soil samples improve. You know, like where Butch and I were talking a couple weekends ago, we were putting out some fertilizer and some lime on our food plots, and I did the math on it. I was like, you know, comes out to about $500 a year per acre in synthetic, you know, fertilizer and lime, and the goal is to get off of that need over time. But when you start doing the math on that, significant investment every single year that with no sign of that ending. And I have started to see the soil tests improving on my place. We're not where we need to be yet, but we're working towards that. I know that's been a really, really good feeling for me. And I'm sure you guys get a lot of gratification out of that as well.
Yeah. Well, and I was telling you before, I mean, out of our 330 acres on our north ranch, 100 acres of that is wetland, protected wetlands. So, and you know, from the cattle perspective, I'm looking at it, I'm like, well, there's 100 acres that I can't have pasture there. You know, that's, you know, and it was more of like a headache from, you know, the beavers flooding out my roads and causing water issues. But in reality, we're actually following the state of Florida best management practices. And through TINA, we've contracted to really revitalize those wetlands and take advantage of some grants that are available, because it's phenomenal duck habitat, and really creating a permaculture on our farm. And it's just the diverse wildlife or just the financial gain of being able to do that work and finding the people to help you do that work. It's kind of turned into a blessing, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you turn and it exposes you to different walks of life and different people. And to me, it makes the whole thing a lot more interesting too. You don't know what you're getting into until you get into it. But, you know, I think most people have probably seen some form of documentary or video of a Japanese guy with Kobe beef, and he's out there massaging the cows. And like Butch said, they got their special music on and this very low stress environment. How much of that is realistic? Like, are there any special care requirements? Laura, is that what you do? You go out there every morning and give them a good full body massage? I mean, what's going on out there in terms of Wagyu, like really the specific care of that breed?
Well, like Wes mentioned earlier, the fact that they produce so much more cortisol, keeping them calm is really, really important. The steers that we're finishing out, you know, it's very important for them to just not move a whole lot, stay as comfortable as possible. They do love to have their heads and back scratched. They just have a wonderful quality of life without doing much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we don't restrict movement. I mean, that's something. So the Japanese will, you know, they'll, and that's the ethical treatment of the animal. You know, the way we, mm-hmm. you know, our husbandry practices. I mean, they got plenty of room. The paddock's got a lot of room. They want to lay down, they can lay down. They got a nice place to lay down. I mean, they got room to move around. You know, some of the finishing protocols maybe in Japan would not be well accepted in the United States if you saw it. You know, because they'll like chain them to a rail and they don't get to move. And we don't really believe that's the best way for the animals to live their life out. But it really comes down to this. Number one is genetics. You got to start off with great genetics. Just because you got, you know, quote Wagyu genetics doesn't mean that you're going to get this amazing product like the steak that Butch just cooked up. You know, but 60% of the equation is genetics. You know, so there's some very specific things we look for there. The second thing is clean water, like we talked about. Got to have good, clean water. A lot of, you know, you go to a lot of ranches and you look at the water troughs and you wouldn't want to touch it, let alone drink out of it. Well, the animal's no different. You know, I mean, you can actually watch the animals drink the water and how they drink, you know, watch their habits and how they're drinking out of it. And, you know, the cleaning up our water was huge. You could just tell right away that the animals, they walk up to the trough, you know, they dunk their head in, they drink right away. And you can tell they like the taste of the water and it's good.
Our farm manager will even drink out of the trough. Like he'll scoop it up in his hands and drink it and smell it. And, you know, okay, if you're going to drink it, I guess it's.
That's the ultimate test.
Yeah.
That's the cowboy ed test.
Yeah,
that's right.
Then the other thing is high quality forage. Okay. We got to get it. They have very specific macros that we need to meet, you know, based on where they are in the evolution of their life. We actually use a gentleman by the name of Dr. Jimmy Horner, who designs our feed protocols. And we follow that very, very closely because we want to get the maximum out of each one of these animals because it can produce a lot, but failure to kind of hit those feed protocols, you know, I mean, you can really fall short. So Jimmy actually flies to Japan. He's got a doctorate from Texas A&M and literally flies to Japan and teaches the Japanese how to oh, feed wow. out their animals. So we're lucky to call him a friend and he's great. But then lastly, low stress. There is a reason why they massage. I mean, I can't get Laura to give me a massage at home, let alone the animals, but low stress is important and it's how you handle them. When it comes time to work in the animals and we're taking them through the squeeze chute and everything. You know, an old cowboy probably wouldn't like the way we do it. You know, when it comes time, like we have to like disbud or dehorn the calves, and that's the most non-fun part of the business, or castrating them. We band our animals, is what we do, but we're cognizant of like doing nerve blocks. So we'll halt the entire operation for 10 minutes while I block their optic nerve that goes up to their horn so they don't feel it. You know, we don't want that animal to be in pain at all. So just taking a few extra steps, giving them some NSAIDs so that they don't feel that pain, and just making sure we're managing that stress so that animal has a great life. You know, the other thing is fly control. You know, flies could be, I mean, it's horrendous in Florida, as you can imagine.
We got some in North Florida.
We got a few, you know, and listen, vector borne diseases are a thing. So, you know, we test our herd once a year for BVD and Yoni's disease, which there's no cure for Yoni's disease. So having a closed herd, we're very cognizant of keeping, you know, anything out. But fly control is important, right? So we actually put up bat boxes. So, you know, we're trying to get bats established on our ranch. Did some research, found out, you know, I was thinking, oh, purple martins. Well, purple martins also eat dragonflies, and dragonflies eat the mosquitoes. So we've got some bat boxes that we're excited about bats coming into. Laura's father, we actually put some up on his farm. And I'll bet you for each one of these boxes,
he says he's got over 100 in one box.
Yeah, but a foot and a half by a foot. And if you just look it up, I mean, the bats are great, you know, you know, so again, just kind of creating that ecosystem on our ranch to let nature do the work. But we do fly control a couple times a year, give them a pour on, and we put some fly control tags in them to keep flies down, get fans everywhere, you know, so that they can get some relief from that for sure.
Doesn't sound like it's too bad of a life.
I kind of want to be a Wagyu cattle at Wes and Laura's farm.
Yeah, minus the last part, but you know, all right. The rest of the stuff sounds good.
Wes always says that our, you know, that our steers only have one bad day ever in their life.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, you mentioned genetics being, you know, super important, probably the most important. How do y'all approach that? I mean, you obviously you had your start. You mentioned you've basically doubled your herd size. How do you approach your breeding and your genetics?
So great question. We're extremely data driven. And this is like, so at night I'm usually like researching data, you know, the breed plan databases and looking at the herd and coming up with matches that make sense. You know, we are dual registered in both the American and Australian Wagyu Association. So we have access to both databases. The Australians, we made the decision to join the Australian Wagyu Association, mostly because they've put a ton of carcass data in there, which means we can make selective breeding choices with an immense amount of accuracy on what the end result's going to be. So we can do mating predictors and we can pretty much know what we're going to get. And we, you know, we follow what's called the Takeda breeding cycle, which is just bringing balance to a line bred herd. It's a little bit of a process of bringing balance to the herd, right? You don't want to just, if you have a herd and you go all in on one EBV, that's an estimated birthing value, you know, so let's say I really want marbling. Okay, well, if I go all in on marbling traits, I'm losing on carcass and I'm losing on maternal traits. And so you got to have a balance of all of that, right? So having a rhythm. So when we do our breed plan on the ranch, we're taking that into account. We're body scoring our animals. We're looking at what traits we like, what we need to bring in. With certain product with our progeny and making sure that we get a nice balanced herd, you know, to kind of build upon. And, you know, genetics is a big part. Yeah. We're looking for consistency of the end product, right? In the meat, but we're starting off with the meat business. The meat business provides us carcass data. So when we take a steer in to the processor, We obtain an image via a specialized camera, which will grade the carcass. Right, it'll tell us how big the eye muscle area is. So the size of the, you know, it kind of gives us an indication on the size of the meat that we get off the animal, and then intermuscular fat percentage, and then marbling fineness. And those as we accumulate that data, we're able to put that into the database, and that helps proof our genetics basically. So that leads into later on seed stock and genetic sales, you know, because we've got some, and we've already got, you know, a few animals that are just absolute rock stars genetically that we're really excited about. And our long-term goal, we want nine line farm progeny and genetics, you know, being used throughout the country with some of our top breeders. That's where we want to get.
Awesome. Yeah, that would be very cool, I'm sure, to give, you know, give back to the whole community in the United States. You mentioned several things there about the marbling, that the genetics makes a difference, obviously. And something else stuck out to me too is you mentioned that the water quality also plays a factor in the marbling. Are there any other factors that go into the marbling of the meat?
Yeah, getting them off of the reason why we bring the finished ears off pasture is we're feeding them seasoned hay. So we eliminate the vitamin A by getting them off of the fresh grasses. So new growth has got that vitamin A. It actually diminishes the marbling in the meat and the final meat quality. So the free choice hay that we're feeding our animals that are in the fat pens, it's all 6 month old hay. So that's all leached out by then. And that helps, you know, and then we've also got some supplements that we give them. So minerals, this is where Dr. Horner has helped us. So giving them the right minerals at the right time. And we've got a supplement that we also give them to make sure that they got all the nutrition that they need to get the most out of that breed.
You know, we wanted to have both you guys on because I love getting the different perspectives from the team that it takes to do anything, whether it's producing cattle or running a business. I mean, it's always a teamwork environment. You talked earlier about some of the challenges y'all face with Wagyu. I want both of y'all's opinions on what is the most rewarding side of it. Cause it's, to me, it's always interesting to see how different personalities feel about the same thing.
I've got a couple. I mean, I think one is just hearing people's reactions after they've eaten, you know, some of our product. Most of them, I mean, it's just like Wes mentioned, it's an experience. And the fact that I know that we played a part in that and we helped them get to that experience, I think is really rewarding. The other one for me is more family-based. you know, we've got three teenage boys, and to show them what it means to build something and to have passion about something that not necessarily brings in the income, or it's not money driven, that there are other reasons to do hard stuff. I find that really rewarding.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better. I love it when someone eats one of our burgers or has one of our steaks and they go, "That was the best blank I've ever had. Oh my gosh, I'm ruined forever." I mean, it's just, it is extremely rewarding. And to Laura's point, I mean, we want to teach we want to teach our kids great core values. And we felt like, you know, that was really like a big driver. I mean, I want those boys to know where their food comes from, know how much work we're doing. And it is not for, you know, we'd love to break even. It doesn't make a lot of money. You know, I mean, it's hard, and hard work sometimes is worth it, doing the right thing, even though, you know, taking the hard right versus the easy wrong. And it's been a great experience for our family. Not to mention, I think one of the fringe benefits, you know, a lot of people, you know, they look at the investing in buying this meat. And one thing that it's done for us is we know that we only have so many dinners left with our boys. And we've got a group text with our family, and we really work hard. And when you got athletes, school, work, all these distractors, sitting down and breaking bread with the family is just so important. We only have so many dinners left in our lives. We make each one special. And when we got that group text with the boys and we say, "Hey, Wagyu steaks tonight," they're all there. not always fully clothed, but we're all there. We're able to bless the meal together, and we're able to convert, you know, and what I like about Wagyu, and I tell everybody this, I'm like, you're going to eat half as much. So when you look at the price, it's like just half it. And that's what, I mean, it's no different than buying a prime steak at the store, quite honestly, because the way we serve it is we got a cutting board. We slice it all up after it's rested, after we've cooked it, and everyone comes up and grabs, some slices of the steak, and we sit down, we have a meal, and it's just an experience. I think that's been so great for our family. It's just been extremely rewarding. And then when you hear other families doing the same thing, we played a little part in that, and it's truly special.
That is a cool story.
I love the family aspect. I like that. That makes me happy.
Yeah. And, you know, when you talk about making investments, I mean, a lot of what we talk about on this podcast is just the investing side of land ownership. And, you know, you get caught up in the economics, but I always just go back to, you know, you can't do any of this stuff with stock. You're not doing this with a rental property. Like, none of this stuff pulls at you like land ownership does, and all the different ways you can do things on your property. You mentioned how welcoming the community has been with Wagyu, and that really people are trying to help. You feel like there's a lot of room to grow. Where do you see the future of Wagyu farming going?
Great question. I mean, we believe that there's going to be a flight to health and quality. I mean, we have conversations. I'll have prospective clients call me, and we'll be on the phone for like an hour, and I can tell that they've read the same books, they're well-read, they understand health's very important to them, but they also want quality. And that's kind of our consumer. I mean, the flavor of the meat is truly exceptional, but the health benefits, truly remarkable. And I think more people are realizing, like, eliminating seed oils, you know, eating good food.
Wes, I'm glad you mentioned the health benefits, because, you know, I would eat this stuff even if it wasn't good for me. It tastes that good, but, you know, it does feel that much better knowing that it's good for me. Talk about the health benefits a little bit.
Yeah. And the health benefits is really, really what got Laura and I into the breed. But I read a book called Sacred Cow, written by Dan Wolf. Dan Wolf got everyone eating paleo, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. I don't know, maybe it wasn't that long ago, but it seemed like everyone was eating paleo, the caveman diet, right? Well, he did 4 years of research on red meat. And while the book's not specific to Wagyu, he debunks a lot of misinformation out there in regards to the health benefits of red meat in general. And one of the things was that the average Western diet's like a 20-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, which is the reason why we have a tremendous amount of inflammatory diseases running rampant. I'm sure you know somebody with rheumatoid arthritis or ulcerative colitis or some sort of arthritis, some itis. It's usually you know, created by high inflammation markers. And I actually had ulcerative colitis when I came back from Afghanistan. I caught a couple bugs over there and it tore me up. Plus I got a metal hip. I got a bad back. Laura was a Division I gymnast. She's got a bad back and we have all these orthopedic injuries. We're like, man, we can't be popping Advils every day. So inflammation's just kind of been like the enemy for us when we're looking at how we eat. And the nice thing is this breed, it's got like a 3-to-1 omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acid ratio. So it's extremely healthy. You know, the keywords there are nutrient dense and bioavailable. We talk to a lot of women that have iron deficiency. They're having hormone issues. And we always tell them like, hey, just eat 5 ounces of our meat every day for a week. And they usually call and say like, yeah, I feel totally better because the doctor prescribes them pills. That's not absorbable. Like your body doesn't absorb that. It has to be heme iron. It's the only way that your body absorbs that iron. That kind of same thing goes for all the nutrients, which is why we love the carnivore blend, because it's, you know, that 80% of our burger and we mix it with 20% liver and heart. So you're getting that organ meat in. Pretty much it's like getting a B12 shot every morning when I eat it. I mean, you feel like $1 million, you know, you don't really have to take a multivitamin because of the bioavailability and nutrient density. And then just the, just the caloric reduction, you know, it, you know, 100 gram serving of beef provides you 25 grams of protein at 180 calories, you know? So, if you're to get that same level of protein from like non-meat protein alternatives, it would increase to like 236 calories for black beans, 374 calories for peanut butter, 674 calories, you know, eating something else. It just kind of keeps going. You got to eat more calories to get the same amount of protein. So to get that in for you is, it's just a great way to get that. And plus, fat's good for you. You know, the breed, as I talked about, creates a tremendous amount of monounsaturated fat. In fact, it's like 7 times the monounsaturated fat from other breeds. And the full blood Japanese black Wagyu has a genetic trait that actually changes stearic acid into oleic acid. And that's the beauty. The oleic acid is that heart healthy fatty acid. Very great for your cardiovascular system. And that's something that's a genetic marker that we look for. Think avocados or olive oil. That's what makes those healthy. This is the same thing. This meat's chock full of it, you know, and that's really helped. You know, when we go and we get our blood work done, our, you know, she's got her doctor, I got my doctor. They both look at our blood work and they're like, what the heck are you guys doing? We're like, we cook everything in Wagyu tallow and we eat Wagyu meat. And, so they're both clients of ours. They buy our meat. Both doctors have bought a half a steer and they're prescribing it to their patients. So it's really cool to see that come full circle.
You can really tell the difference in the meat too. I mean, just whenever you're cooking it.
That was one of the first things I told you whenever I cooked
it. Super low melting point. I mean, you can really tell the difference. And like you said, the health benefits are there along with great flavor. What do you got to lose?
Yeah, lower cholesterol than fish or chicken, if you can believe it. Knowing your farmer is so critically important. You know, at the last American Wagyu Association event, they put out 30% of Americans have tried Wagyu and less than 10% have actually tried 100% full blood. So there's still, we believe there's a huge market left to tap into and more people to experience. And we love those first timers, man. If you're Wagyu curious, we'd love to introduce you to something that's really going to change your eating habits for the rest of your life. And then lastly, labeling standards. You know, I think, you know, so the USDA, I don't know if you saw this or not, but the USDA has, you know, after some lawsuits, the USDA has made a change to their labeling standards that take effect in 2026, whereby defining what constitutes a product of the United States. So when you go into Walmart and you look at the state, you know, some of the meat in the meat counter there, it'll say product of the USA. Well, that's most likely over 60% of the beef in our grocery stores are imported from another country. We have no idea what the breed is, how it was raised. But they were pretty loose on that. And so they have made it to where that animal needs to be born, raised, and then processed in the United States for it to say product of the USA. So that doesn't take an effect until 2026, but we certainly want to keep pushing for more labeling standards, especially for the Wagyu breeds, as we talked about before with the differences in the different Wagyu meat.
So you mentioned there, Wes, that, 30% of Americans have tried Wagyu. You sound like you guys are doing all the right things. I've tasted this myself. It's incredible. But if you have the best beef in the world and you don't know how to bring it to market or sell it, you're not going to be able to get it to the people that want it or don't know they want it yet. So what have been some kind of the challenges of getting it to market, and how are you navigating selling the Wagyu beef?
Great question. Honestly, it was way harder than what Laura and I ever thought.
I bet.
Because you take an animal, you got a 900-pound carcass, and you carve that all up in a bunch of different cuts. And we were like shipping two ribeyes across the country, and we're like, geez, this is a lot of work. A lot of work for a little itty bitty return. And most of the times we weren't making money, and we're like, what are we doing here with with this business? But Laura can speak a little bit more to the sales. Laura actually handles the marketing and sales side of the business.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really took us by surprise was who our target audience is, who's actually buying the meat. Going into it, we thought it might be more of someone who's just a foodie, right? Food and wine, like just likes to really enjoy a really, really good steak. But the more that we got into it, and the more that we were educating, and then also being educated from the consumers, we found that really who was buying our meat was more of the health conscious person who really, like Wes said, really cares about where their food is coming from. What can it do for me, as opposed to just, what am I eating? So basically, we thought also that restaurants would be an easy sell. Neither of us grew up in the restaurant industry. So that was really a learning curve as well. But through that, we have found that private chefs have been a great advocate for us, a great partnership. They can tell the story of the meat. They appreciate the story. Their customer appreciates the story. They can also honor the meat. And that's really important to us, is to have a chef or a partnership where they can. We use the word honor. I mean, we want that relationship where they can honor what we have spent all of this time producing. So the local chefs in the area have been fabulous.
One thing we realized was we thought that chefs would be jumping over the counter to, serve this meat to their customers, but most of the restaurants are just looking for a profit margin. And
Right.
it was eye-opening to us how many restaurants, especially in the local area. I mean, we're down here on the Gulf Coast, man. We've got some high-end restaurants here, and how many restaurants really weren't passionate about providing a superior product to the consumers? They just want to make a profit, and that was really it. It was all just like bottom line, and that's not really us, so that really wasn't a fit for us.
Yeah. So the other thing that we have found is that, those folks who have found our meat and love our meat really wanted a way where it could be on a subscription base, or they'll be like, oh, well, I just forget to order. So super excited that we recently launched a subscription model. So when you create your own bundle, you can go in and select, 6, 9, or 15 items that you want to put in your custom box. And then you can choose how often you want to receive it. So you can receive it every month, every 3 months, or every 6 months, which we've had just great success with, just because basically it's a create it and forget about it, right? I
Yeah.
mean, it comes to your
Right.
door. Everything is packaged individually, flash frozen, will last up to a year in your freezer, but I highly doubt it will ever last near that long, just because you're going to eat it, obviously. The other thing we've had really great success with is we launched our bulk beef sales. So we offer quarter and half beef shares. It's been great just for those folks who, one, want to have a freezer stocked full, whether it's, you're on the carnivore diet, or you may be a little bit of a prepper, or you just don't have time to go to the grocery store every day. But to know that at any point in time, you always have a freezer full, amazing beef, has been a big success for us. We even have folks who will go in with their neighbors or their friends and buy one together and then split it. It's cheaper per pound that way, for the consumer. And it also helps us, obviously, just because we're not having to, like Wes said, ship out two ribeyes at a time.
Right.
But that's been really a popular way to move meat for us.
Yeah, I really like the subscription service that you guys offer. That way you have that, regular cadence of having the delicious meat just delivered at your door. But if people miss out on that subscription service and don't renew it, where is somewhere locally that they can come back, and be able to get your guys' steak?
Now, great question. Coastal Rancher, we got a partnership with Coastal Rancher. Kate and Mitch down there. They're right behind Stock and Trade off Highway 98. They carry some of our individual cuts. So if you're driving home at night and you're like, you know what, it'd be great, some 9-line Wagyu, you can swing in there and also get some fresh produce, raw milk. They've got a great operation there, and it works really great.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear y'all say that the restaurant industry was a little bit tougher nut to crack than you expected, because from the outside looking in, and I'm no restaurateur, but from the outside looking in, I would think that I would want to provide the highest quality ingredients to my patrons and expect that they're going to, you know, want to pay more for that. Because a lot of times, like when we go out to eat, we're trying to do something we can't do at home. You know, we want to go get something cooked in a way that we're not good at cooking, or go get some ingredients that are hard to obtain. It's interesting to hear you say that a lot of restaurants really, it's just all about profit margin. How can folks find a local restaurant that is as passionate about what they're serving their customers as you guys are about raising Wagyu?
That's a great question. I mean, farm to table. Look for restaurants that promote farm to table from locally sourced farms. You know, you'd be surprised how many restaurants down here on the coast, you know, serve a grouper sandwich, and the grouper's not even from the Gulf of Mexico, and we're right here on the Gulf of Mexico, and it's no different with everything else. Chad Donaldson at Bitterroots is a big client of ours. He's blazing the trail on what right should look like with restaurants. I think he said like 80% of the produce that he uses as ingredients are sourced from local farmers. And I applaud him. And the best part is he's not price gouging his customers either. You know what I mean? And he knows that this is a long-term play. He's doing it for all the right reasons. He came up to the farm. I mean, this is how committed it is. He came up to the farm. I mean, he spent over 2 hours at the farm just walking and me talking with him and explaining everything. I mean, he truly cares. So if you're looking for a chef that like truly puts a great product on the plate, and you know, you want to walk away going like, man, this was truly a special night. I mean, Chad at Bitterroot, unbelievable. Nathan Davis with the Polish Chef, another big client of ours. He's a private chef. He works, if you want to put on a dinner in your house, you know, he comes in and he serves our meat, but he also, I know how passionate he is about sourcing local fresh produce and meat. And so those two guys really come to mind, that I know for a fact you can get a great quality product.
Wes, if there's any chefs listening to this, I mean, how can they reach out to you guys? I'm sure, you know, it's not as simple as just going to the website and you know, picking out a ribeye. I mean, how do they need to get in contact with you?
Yeah, they can just email us at info@9linefarms.com. Laura and I will get that, and we'll arrange a meeting. We'll come bring you some samples and let's talk. You know, we'll explain how we work with our chefs. And if it's a fit, we'd love to work with you.
You know, it's funny you talk about the passion, you know, of these chefs. We've talked a lot about the passion that you guys have for doing this. I'm sure you get a lot of passionate customers as well. I mean, I feel it, you know. I mean, you want to feel good about what you're putting in your body, and then
and your family's body.
Exactly. And that makes you feel connected to the community around you, makes you feel connected to the land. It's easy to get passionate about that. Y'all do some special things for your existing customers too, though.
Yeah. And we have some clients that are super passionate, like you said, and it's so cool. And Laura was smart enough to come up with what we call the community organizer program. And so if you're interested in that, what you could do is go to our website and you can actually sign up, and we give you a code. And so as you sell meat, you get credit towards your future purchases. And that's been a game changer for some of our folks, because they'd come to us and say, hey, I want to sell your meat. And I'm like, well, the commissions are really small. I don't know, you know, there's not a lot of margin in there. But what we can do is, as you're promoting the meat and driving some orders with your code, we can pay that forward to you on future meat sales. And we certainly have some folks that are doing a great job with that. So thank you to, you know who you are, and thank you.
Speaking of that, I've really enjoyed buying the trim. You know, we got a lot of hunters listen to this podcast, and you know, I was frustrated with the same things that you guys were frustrated with in the food industry when it comes to processing venison. A lot of times, you know, we want to process that venison, we want to mix it with beef fat, make some burgers, have some ground meat at the house, and you know, you don't know what you're getting. You don't know where the source of the fat is. You don't know how it was raised. You really don't know anything about it. And just this couple of weeks ago, I actually ground all my venison from this past season with y'all's Wagyu trim, and it is unbelievable. It's taken that to a whole nother level. I hesitate to even bring that up on here. I don't want to ruin my source. Man,
secrets
it's,
out.
It's some special stuff. It's
we got you covered.
Stuff.
We got you covered, Joe.
Y'all just keep a little bit over in the corner for me, please.
But that is the other thing, is that we really like to use the nose to tail, right? Yeah. You know, finding those avenues where we can, you know, sell all of it. And so, you know, someone like you will take the trim. I mean, it's very important to us that there's zero waste.
The thing with when we had the website up and you could just order whatever you wanted, everyone goes in and orders what? They order the three primals, right? And sure. And the reality is every cut on this animal is amazing, right? So we've got consumers where their favorite cut is the Denver steak or the Terry's Major or the Picanha. We got a bunch of Picanha fans now because, you know, we'll cut it up. I'll have some people over, show them how to cook it. And they're like, oh my gosh, this is the best cut on the, you know, if everyone's mm-hmm. got like kind of the favorite. And so what the bulk boxes do is we introduce them into some of these other cuts. If you buy a quarter or a half steer, you're going to have some of those other cuts. It just opens your mind to how many other delicious parts of the animal there are. And some you might end up liking some of these offcuts more than some of the primals, quite honestly.
Yeah. Big Picanha fan over here. I like it
that
a lot.
That is very helpful, I think, for any of the producers that are listening to this, you know, to be able to say, hey, how do we move some of these, not maybe less desirable, but just less well-known cuts? I mean, I know, like, you know, most people have not even ever heard of a chuck eye steak, you know, and then you have one, you're like, why have I been eating ribeyes, you know? So that's a great idea from a marketing perspective is, you know, let the ribeye be the gateway drug to, you know, a shank, so to speak. So, man, y'all have given us a crash course, and I love hearing y'all's story just from start to finish. I can't wait to see where y'all take Nine Line in terms of the genetics and see how the farm progresses. As we wrap up, any memorable experiences for you guys? Anything unexpected happened that just really is stuck in your mind?
We have a bad memorable experience. You know, we've kind of had everything happen to us in the short time we've been doing this. We've pretty much endured a lot of things, a lot of setbacks, but we had an animal get struck by lightning. Mm-hmm. That really sucked, you know, but thankfully we had all the mamas. We had them all synced. We were getting ready to AI them. We were going to do artificial insemination that weekend, and storm popped up. And unfortunately one of the mamas got hit. But fortunately, it didn't hit all of the mamas. We had like 10 mamas in there. We could have lost 10 girls just like that. So really kind of brought some reality that just how fragile this can be sometimes. But I think like the memorable moments, like literally every calf birth is a huge celebration. I mean, every single time one of those calves hits the ground, whether it's able to stand on its own 2 feet or has some challenges and we need to bottle feed the calf for the next 4 months. You know, that's where Ed's wife, Lori, she's the calf whisperer, and she goes on milking duty twice a day, you know, sometimes more, making sure that that calf gets a great start to their lives. We haven't lost a calf yet, which we're really excited about. And that's kind of unheard of in a herd of our size. So, and we anticipate keeping that streak going.
Yeah, I hope so. Like Joe said, I really enjoyed hearing you guys' story and look forward to seeing how you guys do and how it all turns out. Seems like you guys are doing all the right things. So we definitely appreciate you guys being on today. If people want to check out Nine Line and look at your subscription service and looking at some of the things that you guys offer, what's the best way for them to get in contact with you?
NineLineWagyu.com.
Follow us on Facebook and Instagram as well, at NineLineWagyu.
Wes, Laura, it's been very enlightening. I think this whole show kind of listens like advice for newcomers, and you've given a lot of pearls of wisdom, I think, in here. Last question is, any advice for anybody that's considering getting into the Wagyu market?
Well,
be patient.
Yeah,
I think be patient, but know your why. I mean, I think that's really important in this industry, is to know why you want to get into it, because that at the end of the day is what's going to need to drive you, because it's not easy.
That's great advice.
We see a lot of disbursement sales from people getting out of the business, because the cost, you know, when you're talking about the price to get into Wagyu, especially full blood Wagyu, it's astronomical. And there's just, you know, when you have that high cost, initial cost, the risk just goes through the roof. And if you don't have it figured out before you jump into it, it can be pretty tough. Whereas, you know, maybe a different breed that is maybe a little lesser expensive. I would actually encourage anyone that wants to get into it. You know, we've got semen and embryos, some of the best genetics. You got to start off with great genetics. And so if it's something that you're interested in doing, maybe you got a couple cows at the, you know, at your, at, on your place or something, if you have the ability to have a pasture or something like that and have a little small herd, is buy a couple of embryos from us. You're going to drop a full blood Wagyu in 9 months, or we've got two amazing bulls. We've got a whole tank full of, like, you know, some of the best semen in the world. We can sell you some semen. You can do some F1 crosses to start with and just see, you know, I mean, anytime you introduce the Wagyu genetics into any breed, it's going to end up being above prime and result in a better product.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. This week's show is brought to you by Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. There's a lot more to Wagyu than I thought, Butch.
Yeah, you think? Yeah, I mean, all the way down to, you know, the land manager there drinking the water out of the trough, making sure that it's, you know, perfect. That's something that obviously we know water is important to every human, you know, every being on the planet. But man, to make that much difference, as far as I believe the numbers Wes said were 10 to 15% difference as far as the marbling goes on the, you know, the final product of meat based upon that water.
Yeah.
Purity, I guess, would be a good way to put it. That's pretty, it's pretty insane. That is very, very, very minute.
Yeah. I love what they're doing with regenerative agriculture, taking a holistic look at their land management practices for the good of the land and the good of the cattle. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're raising Wagyu or, you know, anything, deer, sheep, you know, whatever, thinking about your land that way, trying to leave it better than you found it, I think is what most landowners want to do. It's cool to hear it in practice. Also, it's also good to hear them be honest about it and say, you know, it is hard. It is a challenge, but they get a lot of value out of it besides monetary value out of it.
Yeah, that's really cool. The whole family, as you and I know, it's not easy work, and to be able to share that with your family and sit down and have an awesome meal, and the health benefits too, man. I mean, that's pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said earlier, you know, I would eat it if it wasn't good for me. It tastes that good.
Oh man.
Funny story. I was actually cooking some of it up the other night for myself and my three-year-old. We had a little mom had taken my oldest out, and it was just me and the three-year-old hanging out doing guy stuff. And I said, let's cook a burger. And he was just talking up a storm, man. He just wouldn't shut up. It was hilarious. But I put that burger down on his plate, and all I did was put a little salt on it. And he took one bite and he just got silent. And he just stared at that burger and just, I mean, he didn't say a word until it was all
gone. Didn't have to. The silence was loud.
Yeah, it's a big deal. And, you know, that's interesting, too, about the truth in labeling, is that you can hear something's Wagyu, but it's really not full-blood Wagyu necessarily.
Right. It's not as
unless
good as
you
it
know it is.
Could be, right.
Yeah, and it can put a for real bad taste in somebody's mouth for it, because it is amazing stuff. Funny how podcasts like this come together. You know, Laura works out at my gym, and I was in there one day working out, and she had a shirt on that said Bougie Beef, and I just asked her, what is Bougie Beef? And that was how this all started. It's how, yeah, you know,
rest is history.
Came to know her, came to know their farm, and came to know Wes, you know, with his experience, you know, that we did on Emergency Action Planning podcast. It's really cool. If you're local, to the Santa Rosa Beach area, or you find yourself over in the, you know, Destin, Panama City area, you should definitely look up those restaurants and those retailers that are selling their product. But if you want to pick some of this stuff up for yourself, definitely go check out their website. Or, you know, if you're a restaurateur and you want to try to bring this stuff into your restaurant and know that you're supporting a farm that's doing their best to do it the right way. And, you know, bottom line, just produces an amazingly delicious product. Y'all definitely look up Nine Line Farms.
Yep. That was a cool podcast, man. I'm looking forward to putting some more of this in my mouth for sure.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week.
Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen. So here's a handy option for you to get the podcast emailed to you each week. Just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list, and wherever you are listening to podcasts, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.